it's at, folks, here at All Things Trek at allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
Oh, man. So I'm not staying at your place anymore.
Nope. You have Bob has moved out of my living room.
I have.
It leaves a big empty hole in the living room. Like, literally, there was an air mattress there, and it's not anymore.
And approximately a 4x6 foot hole.
Yeah. I have about 50% more living room. But it does make me sad that Bob is not living with me anymore.
Well, I had to move out. It's not like I wanted to put my name on a lease here anyway.
Yeah, it's true. The landlords are starting to get on to us.
It's true. But I have such a cool car now.
Do you have a cool car? I haven't actually seen it yet.
It's a Chevy Prism is what it is. It used to be a Geo, is what it was. Geo is a company that was owned by Chevy.
Did it transform and roll out into a new kind of car?
It did.
Okay.
I'll have you know.
All right.
No, it drives really well. It's better than any other car I've ever had, which I've had, you know, these really crappy, like, Ford passenger cars before. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, they definitely spurred me on and know how to, like, work on cars. So, I mean, I have automotive skill and experience now because of the cars I've had. But it's nice to be able to drive a car and not worry about it suddenly petering out or, like, the timing belt suddenly snapping or something like that. It's really a nice feeling.
Yeah, I'm actually sad. Cause
There are two problems with it. They're really minor. The driver door, when I open it, like, swings open really freely because there's no resistance to it. So it's like when you open it, you got to catch it. Otherwise, it's going to, like, just fly away.
Oh, dear.
And then the... you know how in the rearview mirror you get that little switch thing where you can put it up if you're, like, driving at night or so and there's, headlights? That thing doesn't work.
Oh.
So I get to deal with just headlights.
Oh, my.
Such, like, last night I was driving Megan home last night back to her apartment. And, 405 South with headlights everywhere.
Oh, dear.
And there was a truck behind me. And you know how truck headlights, like, the bigger trucks, the F-250s and 350s are, like, higher typically?
Yep.
Right there, lighting up my entire cabin and in my face from the rearview mirror. That was fun, I'll tell you what.
All right. Well, it's been a while since I've had a good rant.
I do enjoy a good Oren rant.
I mean, I don't think I've even done too many on this podcast.
Well, you did the Archer one because you got called out we were on the air.
That was pretty fun. I'm looking forward to being able to do this live again because I enjoyed getting called out and getting to explain exactly why I felt the way I did. Oh, and by the way, for anyone who... I think the number of people who know about us but don't know about SF Debris is probably pretty small, but in case there is anybody, you should totally go listen to SF Debris' review of Nemesis. It's really good.
Shameless plugs.
It's not... I mean, we're plugging someone who's, like, way more famous than we are. It's not really a plug. But anyway,
A plug is a plug, no matter who's saying it.
I'm just trying to represent good Star Trek reviewing.
That's fair.
But anyway, so today we're going to be talking about three things that really piss me off about Deep Space Nine.
Well, you're going to talk about three things that piss you off about DS9. I'm just going to mock you relentlessly on why they're dumb.
That's fair.
Or cool. One of these things will happen.
And, like, I really like DS9. DS9 is my favorite Star Trek show.
Mine too.
Probably my favorite television show, period, now that I think about it. The only show that kind of contends with it is Firefly, which I don't really think counts because it was canceled so quickly, whereas DS9 has 7 entire seasons.
How many episodes of Firefly have? 15?
14.
14?
14 episodes of Firefly. So DS9 is easily my favorite television show that actually, like, went for a full run. But there are still things about it I don't like, and, you know, I chose DS9 rather than Voyager or Enterprise because those are just easy, and I don't want to be picking on the bad shows all the time.
Point of interest.
Yeah?
I don't see DS9 actually syndicated all that much on TV. I see TNG and TOS, but I don't see DS9.
Yeah, there's a reason for that. Paramount basically... they sort of abandoned Deep Space Nine when they started working on Voyager, because Voyager was going to be their new flagship fleet, their new flagship show, and Deep Space Nine was sort of a weird curiosity that they wrote off, and, like, they stopped advertising it nearly as much. They put it in worse time slots to make room for Voyager, because, I mean, Voyager was basically this just originally planned to be the Next Generation again some more, with the same plots and everything.
Well, we saw how well that worked out.
Apparently, I don't know if this is true, but I've been told that originally the Voyager episodes were even numbered starting with 8, as if to indicate that it was the 8th season of Next Generation. I don't know if that's true, but I've been told that, and I could totally believe it. Deep Space Nine doesn't get a lot of syndication because not a lot of people
have watched
it.
Oh, man, that's a thought. Have the 8th season of, if there was an 8th season of TNG, start off with the Enterprise being thrown in the Delta Quadrant instead of Voyager?
Duh-ha, oh my. Oh, dear.
Let that roll around in your mind for a minute.
Although that would be kind of anticlimactic, because the Enterprise has already been flung, like, past the end of the universe, and they got back just fine.
It's true, that's kind of small-scale nonsense.
Like, oh no, we're on the other side of the galaxy, this will take us, like, an entire half an hour to figure out. But, alright, so first up on the list of things that I hate about Deep Space Nine, is Ezri Dax. And I touched on this a little bit during our discussion of the ladies of Star Trek. But just to reiterate...
How do you say her name, Nicole Baird?
I don't know.
Boer?
I assumed it was...
Boher?
I assumed it was Bear, but, like, I don't really know how to pronounce it. And the Wiki... Memory Alpha is very unhelpful on this. It gives me pronunciation guides on all the Star Trek words, but not on how to pronounce the actor's names. Actor's names,
like, actual other relevant information yep. that could be useful in real life. Nah, bro, it's cool. We're not gonna do that.
To understand why I don't like Ezri Dax, you have to understand, first, why I really loved Jadzia Dax. I know that Bob disagrees with me on this one, and for that, he will burn in hell. A very special layer of hell. But, I also respect his opinion. But Jadzia Dax, played by Terry Farrell, was, to me, one of the best characters in Star Trek, especially because, as we pointed out, Star Trek is kind of lacking with good female characters. Before Deep Space Nine, we basically had Crusher, and that was it. And
well, I thought she was a good character, too. I just don't like the character.
Okay, fair enough. And Crusher was a decent character, but she wasn't a great character. And then Deep Space Nine rolls around, and suddenly we have Kira, and we have Jadzia Dax. And I love Kira for a whole bunch of other reasons that I won't get into right now. but, like, Dax shows up, and I really enjoyed Terry Farrell as an actress, and I liked the advancement of Dax, and I really liked the whole dual personality thing they had going on with Dax. Not personality, excuse me, dual roles. Because on the one hand, Dax is Sisko's mentor because of having memories of Curzon, but on the other hand, Dax is Sisko's, like, pupil because Jadzia is much younger and less experienced than Sisko, and so it has, you know, a great duality going on there. And I also like how she shifts, and I feel this is due at least in part to Terry Farrell's acting abilities. I feel that she shifts very seamlessly from, like, sort of headstrong, Klingon-loving, you know, go out and, you know, punch the bad guys to the, you know, sort of the wise old man dispensing advice. And to me, it never felt, like, disjointed. And I was actually kind of surprised to find out that, according to behind-the-scenes stuff, the writers didn't really feel they knew what they were doing with Dax until, like, halfway through the second season. Which, it wasn't what it looked like on the show. I thought they had a pretty good idea just from the get-go. So, you know, good job on you guys there, writers. You managed to fool me. and I also really like the relationships that she has with the other characters. Her romantic relationship with Worf is really great. It gives them both a lot of great development. Through her, we get to see a lot of Klingon stuff, and Deep Space Nine was really awesome for Klingons.
Yes, it was.
And, like, you know, Dax was our conduit to see a lot of those things. The symbiont in general is a cool idea. And so I really love, and, like, you know, Dax is just a perfect example of what I like, of what, you know, what is called a strong female character. And that doesn't necessarily mean a female character who is physically strong. that's a mistake a lot of people make, or a female character who has no weaknesses.
Well, Jadzia does wrestle.
She does wrestle, and she is physically strong, but that's not, like, what defines it. And like, a lot of people also assume a strong female character is one that has no emotional weaknesses, which is what I like to call a boring female character.
Yep.
And Dax
has those are boring characters in general.
Yeah, and Dax has you know, emotional weaknesses, just like all the other characters on the show. She has, like, she's complicated. She has strengths and weaknesses. Anyway, great character in my opinion. Then Ezri is sort of tainted right off the bat because of the reason that Jadzia left the show, that she died, both in-universe and out-of-universe, which originally I thought was due to her actress wanting more money. Then I think, as we've mentioned before, Bob told me the story about her getting pulled to work on another show, which is just really sad. And then in-universe, she doesn't have a very good death in-universe either. Like, basically, Dukat shows up and kills her to prove the show that he has superpowers now. And her death doesn't really accomplish anything.
Well, she went to the temple to go pray, more or less, just, I don't know, in vain or whatever it was.
Well, she was praying because...
The prophets or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, yes. She was starting...
Because Worf and her wanted to have a kid.
Yeah, basically. That was how the episode started.
Right, and then Dukat shows up right there because he wants to snap some...
Yeah, and it was just sort of... It was a very random
He wanted to destroy
death.
The orb that was there on the station.
Or steal it, I thought.
No, he wanted to destroy it.
Did he want to destroy it?
Well, okay. His goal is to destroy. He had initially told Weyoun and, God, what's the other guy's name?
Damar,
that he was going to steal it, but he ended up, like,
okay,
looking at it. He opened the box thing up, and that big, you know, jet flame thing shot out of him, and he destroyed it, so.
Okay, I'd forgotten about that.
And Jadzia just happened to be there.
Yeah, exactly. And
it was just like, oh, can't death, have witnesses.
her death felt very random, and there was
Well, it was random.
Yeah, there was one episode that I really wish she had...
Because she was literally just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
There was one episode that I really wish she had died in, which was the... I wish I'd looked up the name of it, but it's the one where she and Worf are sent to go get a Cardassian, like, double agent.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, like, she's injured. And, like, it's this big, like, dilemma for Worf where he has to choose whether or not to take her back to the runabout for medical care or to go and complete the mission. Mm-hmm. And basically he chooses to sacrifice the mission. They lose the double agent. He's killed. And I really wish Dax had died in that episode because that was, like, a big drama of Dax's death. But, like, in this episode, it kind of felt like when she actually did die, it felt like kind of like an afterthought. It was like, oh, we needed to kill Dax. Moving on. And despite that, her aftermath for her death was very well handled. They, like, had several episodes where the different characters were mourning her death, and they never stopped talking about her. It wasn't like with Tasha Yar, where they just pretended she never existed. So then we have Ezri, who is pretty much the exact opposite of Jadzia in almost every way. She's very weak. She's very timid. She's very confused and, like, you know, and to an extent, I see what they were trying to do with Ezri. Like, they were in a tough spot. They were like, all right, we need to replace Dax. How are we going to replace Dax? We don't want to just shove in a new character halfway through season 6. I get what they were trying to do. They don't just want to replace Dax with also Dax. That would have been boring.
Yeah.
If we just gotten a carbon copy of Dax with a different body. So I get that it was in a tough position, but I just cannot like Ezri at all for a number of reasons. And the first, I think, is just that she has no reason to be on the show. Like, basically, the characters keep her around because she reminds them of Dax. Like, you know, she's a ship's assistant counselor, and she's not even very good at it. If you want an example of Ezri's counseling...
Well, I don't think we actually ever saw her before she got the symbiont. So after the symbiont, after she receives the symbiont on the ship or whatever it was that was on its way back to Trill,
yeah,
we see her in this state of being disoriented and confused a lot of times because she can't sort out, like, who's who.
Well, right, there is that.
Right, so, I mean, we don't actually know how competent she was.
Maybe she was really good before she got joined with the symbiont. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I mean, if you want an example...
She's an ensign, so she must have been in Starfleet for probably, like, 2 years or less, you know, right?
Yeah.
So she's probably really new at her job in the first place, and now added in the mix all this sudden emotional... like, turmoil and confusion on who you are exactly.
Yeah, I mean, if you want an example,
I mean, suddenly
of
there's, like, there's 7 or 8 other people in that symbiont?
Yeah, I think eight's the number.
Eight with Jadzia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you want an example of Ezri's counseling skills in action, just watch her try to counsel Nog in It's Only a Pale Moon when he's all sad about losing his leg, and he instead ends up getting counseled by the hologram, of all things.
I don't want Vic Fontaine to be my...
Yeah, well,
you know,
so would I if
too.
I had to choose between them. and, like, then she's... Then, on top of that, she's, like... Her reasons for staying on the station are completely ass-backwards. Basically, she's... Like, her whole problem is that she's having trouble differentiating herself from her past lives, right? That's her entire... That's her biggest issue. Because she wasn't prepared for the joining. But then... She decides to stick around a place that is full of Jadzia memories and people who knew Jadzia and will project their expectations of Jadzia onto her. And it's like, you know, it's just inviting further, emotional problems. I mean, I get that maybe she wouldn't want to stick with her family, and we see her family later and they're really, really unpleasant. So I understand why she wouldn't want to stay with them. But she had to
Isn't her mom kind of, like, all pissed off at her for getting a symbiont?
Her mom is just pissed off at everyone. I don't understand her mom's motivation. Her mom just hates everyone. And then she has, like, a frustrated brother artist who's, like, competing for the most useless prize. And then she has her other brother who's very distant and just involved in running the company and doesn't really have time for anyone else. So I totally get why she didn't want to stick around with her family going through this difficult ordeal. But, like... I have a hard time believing that the Symbiosis Commission didn't have someone who could help her with this problem, especially considering that, like, that's their entire job, is to make sure that
things,
you know,
aren't a problem.
to make sure that the joinings go smoothly. And considering that the Dax symbiont is a very old symbiont, I mean, like, 9 lifetimes. And granted, they never come out and say exactly how long a symbiont usually lives, but if, you know, if you check the soft canon, the stuff that's not from the show, most of the other examples we ever see of Trill are, like, maximum 4 or 5.
4 or 5 years?
No, I mean, lifetimes. And, like, they sometimes get older than that, but clearly Dax, at, like, 8 or 9 lifetimes, is a very old symbiont.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Symbiosis Commission was like, no, no, just leave. Just go deal with this.
Just go deal with it.
And that, especially, and considering how important it is for Trill to have each symbiote be a new life. Like, Trill have all these rules and social restrictions to make sure that the symbiont doesn't just keep reliving the same life over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just dumped Ezri back on the station. And it's not like she performs some essential function. She does not. There is nothing she does that couldn't be done better by somebody else. except have sex with Julian, but then I remembered O'Brien's on the station. So that would have been way better. I'm sorry, I had to do that.
If Keiko was only more like a man.
If Keiko was more like a man. And then, of course, there's the fact that Ezri is a retcon. And I mentioned this before in the Ladies of Trek, but it bears repeating that Ezri, as we learned in Equilibrium, I think that's the name of the episode, where Jadzia is having flashbacks to Jiran, mm-hmm. we learned that everyone except the highest levels of the Trill Symbiosis Commission believes that only like 1 in 1,000 or like 2%, I guess those aren't really the same numbers, but they say both of them. So either 2% or 1 in 1,000 Trill are capable of joining. And if you stick a
symbiote... No, that's what they tell everybody.
Right, that's what I'm saying. That's what everyone thinks. And if you put a symbiote in somebody else, it will kill them both.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the actual number is closer to 50%.
Right.
But the surgeon who put the Dax symbiont in Ezri almost certainly didn't know that.
No, it's cool, bro. This shit's like USB. Plug and play. It's good to go.
He just checked up memory alpha, whatever. but even if he did know, that's still a 50% chance that he will kill both patients to save one.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's just, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, but that seems really morally unethical. And, you know, just like a very foolish risk to take.
No, that's cool, bro.
Especially
it's USB.
Since...
It's USB. Just go with it.
Just go with it. I mean, unless we're assuming that the Federation is going to say that Dax as a life form is more valuable than Ezri as a life form, and so it's worth it to risk Ezri's life to save Dax.
I mean, it seems like that you're suggesting that anyway.
That's the only thing I can think of to justify it, and it's something I don't
want... Because you've harped on Ezri so much now, and then how, like, the symbiont Dax is, like, 9 lifetimes and expected as, like, 4 or 5.
Okay.
It sounds like it was pretty important to me.
Okay,
the
all
way
right.
you were putting it.
All right. I'm sorry for that.
No, it's cool. It's just...
that completely violates all the canon that we have about the Trill, and, like, it's just kind of lazy. And I just, I don't know, that annoyed me. Oh, and then there's, like, a literal, retcon is that under Ezri's watch, Jiran, who went from a guy who like murdered his music professor to like Hannibal Lecter, and was like this full on like serial killer who understood the mentality and was like an expert at other serial killers. We see this in Field of Fire, which is the episode where Ezri Dax has to catch a serial killer, which is, to be honest, like not the sort of premise I would expect from watching Ezri. I'm just imagining the writers' room where they were like, "All right, guys, so what does Ezri do?" Well, she mainly is a counselor and has identity issues. All right, so in this episode, she's gonna catch a serial killer, and it's like, how did that come up? Of course, that was also the episode where they did a foolish thing, was where they introduced a very practical device and then couldn't figure out why no one ever used it, which was the rifle that shoots through walls. And it's like, guys, if we have one of these things,
well, it was what's it called, a TR-116 rifle.
Yeah.
With a custom fit micro transporter on the end of it. Which is pretty rad. But that's not standard issue. Keep that in mind.
No, but like apparently you could just replicate one. It's not like they're hard to make.
Why hasn't anyone thought of this before?
Like, you know, they're more effective than phasers. They're probably not like shut down by all those random energy fields that make phasers not work. You know, it's just a thing that sci-fi does sometimes.
It's a chemical projectile. Chemical?
It's especially something that Star Trek does, where they will occasionally introduce this really rad device and then have to, like, pretend it never existed because it's better than everything that they normally use.
Oh, man. This is going to be a bit of a tangent, but...
Okay,
tangent
away.
You read The Return, right? A long time ago or something like that,
The
or
Return.
You vaguely remember it.
That's
the one
where, like...
with William
Kirk...
Shatner, where Kirk is brought back to life. With Bork,
I actually never read
Romans.
It, but my mom told me about it as she was reading it.
Okay, so there's a scene where Picard is on this, like, special ops team and is being, like, grab-shooted by, like, shuttlecraft into, like, this like Borg colony thing where these Borg had come in. Anyway,
I would say that's really silly, but there's actually canon precedent for that.
There is. There's a Klingon on the team. Uh-huh. And later on, they're like fighting the Borg and whatnot, and the Borg adapt all this good stuff. And the way it's described to me is that the Klingon suddenly whips out something akin to a flintlock pistol. Is the way it was being described to me. Yeah, just reading the words, I'm like, this really sounds like what a flintlock pistol would be like, but Klingon style. And the Klingon just whips out that and shoots a Borg with it. And drops the Borg with what I think is a flintlock pistol.
Oh my goodness.
If someone listening to this can tell me if it's in fact a flintlock pistol or not, that'd be fantastic. But I mean, it really sounded like he was using some old-timey, like, flintlock Klingon pistol.
Well, remember, in Star Trek, the way that you defeat the Borg is by going backwards.
That's right.
Either, if it's not, you know, otherwise use some kind of endlessly replicating computer virus, because the Borg have no defenses against
it. Oh man, bows and arrows.
Oh. Ooh. I think we just discovered the end of the Borg.
The end of the Borg. Yeah, equip everyone. We need some longbowmen on this right now.
Guys, we're gonna get a unit of pikemen to deck 5. You know, I've always said that the spear is an underappreciated weapon for the zombie apocalypse. I figure it'll handle space zombies.
Borg don't move very fast.
Nope. Alright, so anyway.
It's like this image of, like, red shirts running through the halls now with these bikes on the Enterprise.
I mean, that's not too far off from what happens in Star Trek Online. I mean, they have swords in Star Trek Online instead.
We do have
but
swords.
You could equip an entire squad with swords.
We could if we wanted to. Or the really sweet Vulcan Lerpa.
Oh, dear. I totally mentioned this. That was what happened to me when I was trying to play the intro Federation quest. I had to kill a bunch of drones, and this asshole with a batleth ran through and killed all the drones before I could get to him. And I was like, hey, I needed those. Why did you... But anyway, back to Ezri. There's a little bit more with Ezri that annoys me, which is that the other thing that we see Ezri do, where she, like, finally starts to earn her pay, as it were, is...
Well, it's not saying anything we can't take back.
Well, okay. She basically serves as a bridge officer on the Defiant. And I'm not entirely clear what she's actually doing, but she has a console. And, like, I know she's not targeting the weapons, because that's Worf's job. Maybe she's running the sensors or communication. I don't know. But she's suddenly a bridge officer on the Defiant.
No, Nog does communications.
Okay, I don't know. If someone listening to this can tell me what it is she's doing on the Defiant, I would like to know.
Nothing important is the answer.
But anyway, she's a bridge officer, and she's at one of those consoles. In theory, she's doing something important. Maybe she's their ops. She's their ops officer.
That's O'Brien.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of something.
Or wait, no. On the Defiant, the ops and navigation helm, all I guess, stuff is combined into one helm at the front, I think is how
that's done.
Oh, damn.
That's a really busy console.
Well, I mean, there aren't really too many operations you have to worry about on the Defiant, because it's a warship, right? I mean, like, on the Enterprise, like a Galaxy class, you got, like, all sorts of stuff you gotta be worried about, right? Mm-hmm. But on Defiant, it's just like, is the engine good? All right. Are the weapons good? All right. Are the shields good? All right.
Don't have to worry about
let's
someone's
go somewhere.
Don't have to worry about someone's fifth grade science project.
Yeah, it's just like, I mean, your power outing needs probably aren't really all that intense, because we're only talking about a ship that's, what, 5 decks tall?
Yeah.
4 decks, 5 decks, something like that, right? So there's not really a whole lot of systems on that ship you need to be worried about.
Well, anyway, she's doing something on the bridge, and in theory it's an important job where they wouldn't have someone on the bridge doing it. But, like, she has no training for that. And the implication is that somehow she magically got all the knowledge she needed from her previous lifetimes, from Jadzia. But, like, we know that's not how Trills work. We know that the symbiont gives you, like, guidelines, and, like, you can learn a little bit from the symbiont, but we know that, like, the reason Jadzia was a super scientist wasn't because she gained a bunch of science knowledge from the symbiont. She was already a scientist, and then she got the symbiont. And after she got the symbiont, she took up martial arts, but she didn't just magically know martial arts. She, like, just became interested in it because of her gymnast background in one of her previous lives. I think it was actually her first life was gymnast. That was the one that had an affair with McCoy, which was awesome. But anyway, like, we know from Jadzia that you don't just magically gain a new set of skills when you get the symbiont. Like, you can maybe be better at those skills if you choose to pursue them, but clearly Jadzia had to work these skills.
Right.
But apparently the implication is that Ezri just gets them for free.
For free.
For free. And again, it's just like, I'm going to throw around the word retcon like it's candy here. But it's just, really, she had no place on the bridge. There was no reason for her to be on the bridge of the Defiant. There's no reason for her to be on the station. And it's just, it's kind of painful when you watch the way she interacts with the other crew members, especially in her first season or so. And then by the end of season 7, she finally starts to fit in, and you can kind of forget all the other stuff that happened. And, you know, so that's Ezri, and I just, this is a little bit hypocritical, because I honestly don't know exactly what I would have done if I was in the writer's place and suddenly I was told, no, Dax is leaving, by the way, what do you do? I'd be like, oh, all right, I don't...
I would have left that hole. I wouldn't have put anyone else in that spot.
You just would have left it?
I would have left it, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I would have redone the death scene definitely differently.
Yeah. Made
it, you know, different. I had her die at some other point. But, I mean, her contract was up at that point. And...
Well, they knew a few episodes in advance that she was leaving. It wasn't like they were told the day they started shooting this episode that she's not going
to
be
But I want
yet.
To believe that so hard.
I mean, they're not, like, you know, they're not that mean when they take away one of your actors.
Yeah, but I would have made it to where there was no Jadzia at that point. So everyone, we could see everyone kind of try to move on with this huge hole missing suddenly.
Yeah.
Or this, you know, character not there anymore.
I mean, I think canonically they should have, just to keep the setting intact, they probably should have gotten a replacement science officer, but I wouldn't have made them a huge character at that point. Or even just have, maybe even just have a line of dialogue about how, like, they're not going to send us a replacement science officer because we're in the middle of a war. We don't actually need a science officer right now.
Don't need science all up in here.
But anyway, so that's Ezri. So, moving on to my next topic of anger is the Space Jesus and the Space Antichrist story. And by that I'm referring to Sisko and Dukat. And you have to wonder, where am I getting Space Jesus from? And that's because as the show reaches its final season, you basically got Sisko, who was in the role of the Messiah, saving the galaxy at the behest of the prophets, who are effectively gods, and Dukat, who is, you know, the role of the anti-Messiah, for lack of a better word, who's powered by the Pawraiths, who want to do something bad. It's not exactly clear what they want to do, but we know it will suck.
It will suck.
These are clearly savior stories. This is clearly a savior story. And Sisko is going to save us, if not from our sins, at least from someone else's sins. And I have to admit, part of this comes from the fact that I just don't terribly like Sisko. He's not a bad character.
Really? You don't like Sisko?
Not really. As DS9 characters go, I think he's pretty much at the bottom of my list for main cast members. Obviously, there are certain side characters I don't particularly care for. And I don't think Sisko's a bad character, I just think he's kind of mediocre compared to all the other ones that they have. And I like Avery Brooks as an actor, don't get me wrong. But Sisko, to me, Sisko just kind of comes off as being a little too holier than thou, for my liking. There's just a thing that I just don't like about him. Especially after Picard, whose entire, like, thing was that he wasn't going to judge you.
When do you think he became that way?
I just think that was always what he was like. And you see it especially in The Sons of Moog, which I may have mentioned before, where basically he just tells, like, you know, The Sons of Moog is where Kern, Worf's brother, comes to the station. He's in disgrace because of Worf's actions. He's lost everything. He has no real chance for redemption. And he's like, all right, Worf, I want you to help me die with honor and perform this suicide ritual where you will kill me because dying by my own hand is dishonorable. And this is an accepted Klingon custom. Klingons do this on a fairly regular basis when, you know, they have no other recourse. And so Worf is like, okay, he's really sad. He doesn't want to kill his brother, but he understands that to his brother, his honor is more important than his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows, and Worf is not, Worf realizes that even though he doesn't necessarily feel that way, he's not going to force his values on Kern because he feels that Kern should keep living.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sisko finds out about this and just, like, lays down the law in this, like, preachy tirade about what Worf is doing. And it's like, it clearly has no respect for the Klingon culture or for Kern's wishes in this matter. And it's just, like, so incensed that Worf would do this horribly barbaric action. And at that point, it's not even a matter of the episode treating it like Sisko is imposing his own morality. The episode suddenly starts acting like Sisko was right all along, and suddenly Worf and Dax are like, yeah, Sisko was totally right. I don't know what we were thinking. And then it's driven home even more by the fact that their final solution to this problem is to wipe all of Kern's memories.
Effectively kill him
anyway.
Yeah,
which is effectively killing him anyway. And it's like, okay, I guess he's biologically still alive.
He's just not the same guy.
But he's not the same person anymore. And I really don't like that episode. I like what that episode was trying to do, but I don't like the way they executed it. And that episode really summed up the things I don't like about Sisko, is that he's just so certain that he's right. And you see that also in his dealings with Eddington. Like, basically, after the first episode with the Maquis, he never stops to question whether or not the Maquis might have some kind of standing. Like, which is kind of weird, because in the first episode with the Maquis, he's like, hey guys, you know, he's like, the Maquis are, you know, it ends that episode with him saying, I'm not going to shoot a good man for defending his home, when he lets Cal Hudson escape.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess Cal Hudson is his friend. But then suddenly, when it's Eddington, who he has a personal dislike for because Eddington betrayed him, he's like, Maquis must die. Like, I hate all Maquis, and I am so certain that I am right.
Got the impression that he hated all Maquis as a result of that.
I know
it was pretty much because Eddington had betrayed him, and I saw him pursuing Eddington, you know, really hard, you know, like a hobo trying to track down.
Well, I mean, he virus bombed an entire planet of Maquis.
He did. It's true.
And like, you know, to get Eddington, which, and like, he clearly just has no sympathy for the Maquis' plight and for their struggle. Like, he thinks that, you know, he sees them as nothing but a group of terrorists, and he is not at all prepared to look at it from,
Maquis had also started, you know, scaling up their activities against Starfleet as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Before Sisko came along and virus bombed planet, like, they attacked the Malinche.
Yeah.
Malinche?
I do remember the Malinche.
That thing was bleeding in space. From what, Peregrine fighters or something, or what do you want to call them?
Well, they left like a fake distress beacon, and when the Malinche showed up to investigate, it like beat the shit out of them, and then like knocked out their shields somehow, and then they got attacked by the Maquis.
Yeah, because I don't recall the Maquis really being on Sisko's radar until the Maquis started targeting Federation and Starfleet installations. Or putting them higher on their priority list anyway, and making them, like, Sisko's problem.
Right. Well,
they became Sisko's problem at that point, because, I mean, all those industrial replicators got taken away, and the Malinche and other things were happening, Sisko's like, alright, no more kid gloves.
Yeah.
You guys aren't really defending your homes anymore, so which is actually just, like, committing wanton acts of piracy and terrorism now, also against the Federation, which makes you now really my problem.
I feel like those situations are a little more complicated than that, and I feel like Sisko just sort of boils it down to, you know, you're my, you know, he puts on his blinders and is like, I'm just going to punch you till you stop going.
Does Sisko operate any other way?
And, you know, that's like, I think the situation was more complicated, and I feel like we sort of like pushed all the complicatedness of the situation aside so it could be very simple.
Well, they wanted it to be very simple because it was just the ones that were, the conflict that was at the front of most of this episode was Sisko v. Eddington.
Yeah.
Right? So.
All right, but anyway, so that's you know, I'm not saying Sisko's a bad character. He's just not I just don't think he's very good by Deep Space Nine standards. And then we have Dukat, who is the other side of this storyline. And I love Dukat.
Dukat's so rad.
Is, in my opinion, the best villain Star Trek has ever had. One of the best villains I've ever seen on television, period. Because he's complex, he's multidimensional, he's scary, he has, like, motivations that you can understand, but also hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not, like, one of those villains that, like, sometimes they overdo it a little bit, and the villain, like, becomes, like, so sympathetic that you start end up rooting for the villain instead, and that's not really what, they didn't do that with Dukat. You know, with Dukat, you always have the presence of mind that this was a man who murdered a bunch of Bajorans and doesn't feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you always know that, but then at the same time, you see that he really cares for his daughter, he cares for his people, even if it's part of his own, like, self-serving ambition. So, you know, Dukat is just a very complex character. And what's the guy who plays Dukat? You know his name.
Marco Lamo.
Marco Lamo is really awesome.
I'm pretty sure that's how you announce it.
And without Marco Lamo's really long neck, we wouldn't have the Cardassian neck ridges.
Yep.
So, you know, just really good stuff all around. But then, and he also had a really great antagonistic relationship with Kira, I think. I think that was one of my favorite relationships of the show. But then once he becomes Space Antichrist, basically right after his daughter dies, he stops being sympathetic at all. He's not like, you know, he's no longer doing things for any reason that any of us could identify with, unless, you know, you're secretly harboring a desire to end all life in the universe, in which case I suggest you see a therapist.
Truer words were never spoken.
But, I mean, because, like, before that, even when he allied with the Dominion, you could still see why he did it. Like, you didn't really agree with it, probably, but you could see where he arrived at that logic.
Well, I think it's because we were all rooting for the Federation and, you know, the Defiant and all that stuff is why we don't like it. I mean,
Or
why we don't see eye to eye with that is because they're not the quote-unquote good guys,
mm-hmm.
You know? But I think it was a good move. on his part. I mean, the Klingons were warring all over Cardassian space. Maquis sweep field in a matter of week.
Oh, dear. You know?
That's a Bridge Commander inside reference, actually. Did you want to explain that real quick or no?
I think we mentioned last time.
Have we?
In one of the Bridge Commander mods we installed, the Peregrine, the ship that the Maquis use, is like the best ship in the game because it's so small that the other ships can't hit it. And it can just hover in your blind spot and shoot you with lasers until you die.
Yeah.
I think the only ship capable of beating it is actually the Bird of Prey. Because the Bird of Prey actually, like...
Did we actually set up that fight?
Yeah, my brother did that. And, like, the Bird of Prey can turn fast enough to actually target the Peregrine.
Interesting.
Whereas the Defiant cannot. And I suppose there are some of the ships that, like, have no blind spots that can beat the Peregrine. Like, you know, the giant Dominion battlecruiser can beat the Peregrine because it has no... There's no area for the Peregrine
there's
to sit.
There's nowhere it can't shoot.
Yeah, exactly.
But Dominion come in and, like, sweep the Klingons up out of the space, and Gowron comes back to the station like...
We just got punched in the snout, guys.
The Cardassians got buddies now. Will you be our buddies? Only if you sign the Khitomer Accords again.
Yeah, we're not having any of this business.
Grudgingly thumbprints himself on the pad.
But anyway, so that's, you know... But, like, after he becomes, you know, Space Antichrist, he stops being sympathetic and is just suddenly out to destroy all life. Or something to that equivalent. And I thought that was kind of a disservice to his character, even though it does make way for Damar, and Damar is awesome. Damar gets some really cool stuff going on by the end of it. And then
there's one thing that always kind of bothered me about his transformation into being this, you know, kind of antichrist figure that we see here, at least as far as our conversation goes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we have in, what's the name of the episode? Fortune Favors the Bold, is that the one? Or is it Sacrifice of Angels?
Fortune Favors the Bold is the first episode, and then Sacrifice of Angels is the one where they actually retake it.
Alright, so when the Defiant manages to break through the line or whatnot, and those poor birds of prey and the Mirandas get blown away, and Defiant's the only one that's managed to make it through the hole, even though there's a shit ton of space, you know, like, around.
Space isn't as big as you might think, it turns out.
Apparently. And Defiant gets through the lines, warps the DS9, the minefield comes down, they see it happen, they go into the wormhole, and then Sisko has this prophet experience, which point Sisko's like, look, you need to deal with this problem or I'm going to die.
Like, you know? Seriously, dudes.
Like, I understand that you want me to turn tail and run and be alive, but it's like, I have to deal with this problem. And the prophets intervene and wipe out the fleet or temporarily displace them
or something.
They do something with it. We don't really know what exactly. I think they just vaporize them.
Well, considering the Prophet's distaste for direct violence, I just assume they kick them back out of the wormhole.
Just leave?
I mean, you know, that just seems fairly logical to me, considering what we've seen the Prophets do in the past.
Yeah. So, then the Defiant comes back out, and Dekat starts to lose his mind. He's like, where's the fleet? Where's the fleet? Where's the fleet? Did he actually ever make the connection that the Prophets, like, sent the fleet away?
Well, considering that he eventually goes and joins the Parates, I'd say it's fairly likely. I don't ever recall
seeing that
epiphany
on his part going, oh my gosh, the Prophets did that. I should join the Parades.
It never happens on screen. I could see it happening off screen fairly easily. I mean, it's not a huge leap of logic to be like, well, okay, so our fleet that was like enormous didn't come through the wormhole and the Federation didn't have anything there to stop them. So who else could have done it? So that's, you know, it's true. I would have liked to see that.
Because that's always kind of stuck in my mind. It's just like, obviously he would have had to have known that, I think, in order for this, you know, love of his for the Paw race to suddenly crop up. I really feel that's a thing he would have needed to have had.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, up until that point, he'd been like, you know, Bajoran faith, oh, wishy-washy, ooh, voodoo, crazy witch doctor nonsense. You know, that's kind of how the Cardassians viewed, you know, the Bajoran faith. And he was one of those guys, definitely, that was on that train.
True.
Then suddenly it's just like, ooh, Paw race, ooh.
Evil, well, because
it's just like that acknowledgement that the prophets had everything to do with their defeat at DS9 would have had to have, you know, taken place there. Something like that would have had to have happened.
Maybe it happened when he was in therapy. I don't know.
the therapist was like, yeah, that was the prophets.
And so, basically, as of Waltz is the episode where we really get to see Dekat start to transform into the Antichrist. And it's like, up until Waltz, Dekat was clearly Kira's villain. And that was their big thing. But then after Waltz, suddenly Dekat is Sisko's villain, even though before they didn't really have
I think he shifts back and forth during the season.
Well,
the series.
Well, I guess. I mean,
it really, really has everything to do with what his position and rank is within the Cardassian military in a very, very direct way. Because when he's in command of, like, the the military order, what do you call it?
The Central Command?
Yeah, when he's in charge of Central Command, he's very much all up in Sisko's face, and that's especially apparent during the episode Defiant.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they're not really, they're working together in that episode in particular, but whenever Dukat's in a authoritative, like, command position, mm-hmm. it's always with Sisko that he's kind of butting heads with. Whenever he's in a position to where he's not in that sort of authoritative position, like when he commands the freighter, for instance, where yeah. they get the Klingon bird of prey later, he is then Kira's antagonist.
Yeah.
So it's in like a very, very direct way, I feel. It's like if he's in command of something that is, you know, has, you know, like a bigger command structure of some sort, he's very much Sisko's antagonist. When he's not, he's in these lower ranks, he's Kira's. In the same way that we have, you know, Sisko's in command of the station and Kira's just the subordinate.
I guess that's true. I don't know, I feel like before, like, pretty much, like, after Waltz, like, Dukat and Kira really have no interaction other than that one time when he, where he shows up and is like, hey, I totally had sex with your mom, and then leaves.
Was the one where he had the cult before that or after that?
Okay, I'm wrong, yeah, it was after that, right, okay, I guess that's egg on my face, I forgot about the cult episode.
I don't remember the name of the episode, but he had like this.
Yeah, I know the one you're
Empok
talking
Nor,
about.
Is that where he's doing it?
Yeah, everything evil happens at Empok Nor. Empok Nor is just not a nice place.
Which somehow hangs sideways in space against everything else.
Well, because you know,
plus, you know, it's abandoned. I don't know why that matters if it's hanging sideways in comparison to everything else, though. Because I guess everything is upright and hangs out on the same plane in Star Trek.
But, remember, everything in Star Trek is oriented the same way.
Yeah.
If you're disabled, you lose track of the galactic GPS.
We do see the Defiant do a loop-de-loop, though.
It does do loop-de-loops.
It does do a loop-de-loop.
But the fact that that's a loop-de-loop is only due to the fact that the Defiant is altering its orientation in relation to everyone else. So, you know, welcome.
Yeah.
See, that's why Bridge Commander looks so weird when, like, you're flying at the Romulan Warbird and you realize the Romulan Warbird is upside down. And you're like, what's going on here? And, you know, it gets really weird when you introduce, like, ship rotation.
Oh, Nemesis did that, too.
No.
Nemesis totally had the Enterprise-E doing a...
Well, it did.
Axis rotation.
It did. It rotated, but it was, like, clearly rotating so that the camera still showed that the Enterprise-E was upside down.
Oh, wait, Insurrection did it, too.
Did they?
Yeah.
When?
Remember when Riker's playing chicken with the sonar ship?
Yes.
They totally coming at each other, and the Enterprise flips over and... phasers at the bottom of the sonar ship with their ventral phasers.
Oh. Yeah, I guess they did. But again, in those instances, we still see that the Enterprise is shown to be upside down in relationship to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's still clearly a general orientation. It's just that the Enterprise, for the time being, has flipped over.
Yeah.
As opposed to being... Anyway, it's not all... It's not relative. Not relative. And so, anyway, back to Dukat. After he becomes Space Antichrist, in addition to never really interacting with Kira again, it also takes all of the moral ambiguity out of the scenario. Now it's just, you know, Sisko is good and Dukat is evil. And in fact, Sisko even has a line to that effect at the end of Waltz, where he's like, everything always seems to be a shade of gray.
That is why you're a bad man.
He's like, everything always seems to be a shade of gray,
wait,
but
say that.
Then Dukat. Dukat is black and white.
Yeah.
Like, he pretty much, I forget exactly what he says, but it's basically to that effect. And I just find that story is just not as interesting to me. And then there are the bizarre logical issues with it, where, like, Dukat gets, like, superpowers from the Pawrates, but Sisko doesn't. He just gets some... Maybe that was because of his... Maybe he already used up all of his allotment of prophet powers by stopping the Dominion fleet. I don't know. But
you only,
like,
get one power up, but use it wisely.
But, like, you know, in the final scene, when Dukat and when Sisko confronts Dukat, he doesn't have any powers. He just has, he brings, like, a phaser rifle, and
he's loaded,
like,
for bear when he comes down, it's true.
And Dukat has, like, you know, super glowy evil. But, like, then that entire scene baffles me, because I'm like, wait a minute. So Sisko knew that something bad was going down, and he brought a phaser rifle. So, like, clearly he realized he needed more than just his fists to defeat Dukat, right? Even though that ends up being what he uses.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought a phaser rifle. Why didn't he just, like, bombard the site from orbit?
That's too easy.
Or bring down, like, a squad of security personnel or something. I mean, did the Prophet specifically instruct him, okay, you have to go there alone and not bring any help? And, like, it makes you... And, like, I'm gonna go out on a limb here... that the Pawrates were somehow using their power over time to influence the Prophets and make sure the Prophets couldn't just see how this was all going to turn out. Because if the prophets knew exactly...
Because they're timeless, right?
Yeah, well, because the prophets can perceive time non-linearly. Like, they can see what's going to happen just as easily as they can see what's already happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to go ahead and assume that the Pa'arets were messing with their vision somehow. Because otherwise, that whole scene is really boring, because it implies that the prophets already knew exactly how it was going to turn out, and that everything was preordained. Mm-hmm. And that there was no actual drama. We were just waiting for Sisko to push Dukat off the ledge.
Yeah.
But if that's the case, then why aren't the prophets giving Sisko some of that mojo? We know they can do it. At one point, they possess Kira and give her super mojo. But, like, no, Sisko doesn't get that. Sisko just has to fight Dukat without it. As it just seems like a serious error on the prophets' part. And I don't get why the prophets are being so half-assed about this, considering that this is, like, their lives on the line, too. It's not just, like, it's not like the Pa'arets are going to leave them alone when they escape from the fire caves.
Yeah, I don't know. I really feel that maybe the prophets aren't as, you know, all-knowing as we are led to believe.
I was also very confused why reading some passages from a book would release the Pa'arets. I was like, I get that the prophets are so advanced that they sometimes seem magic, but they're not actually magic. They don't actually cast spells. They have, like, you know, they have advanced perceptions and, like, super advanced technology. But, like, so is the book some kind of technological artifact? Was that what I was supposed to get out of it? I don't know. It seemed very strange that the way this was happening. That, like, these extra-dimensional creatures were vulnerable to, like, I don't know, some kind of ancient chant or something.
But I'm not entirely convinced that the prophets can actually, like, look into the future and know all the outcomes of everything that's ever going to happen or anything like that. Especially since they seem to have no concept of time to begin with. As we get in, like, the first episode, like, time, what is this? Because in the, oh man, what is the name of the episode? The one where Kira and Jake are both possessed, Kira by prophets, yeah,
the Reckoning,
Jake,
I think it's called?
Is that what it's called? Where they,
I know that's what's happening.
They stand on the promenade and shoot red and blue lasers at each other,
mm-hmm,
for
and
a while.
They get nosebleeds.
They get nosebleeds, you know.
That's the sign that shit is serious,
you know,
when someone gets a nosebleed.
They're taking Paradox, mm-hmm, you know, so.
Oh man, sweet mage reference.
That's right. And as the Kira prophet is about to win, where Kai Wind is bombarding the place with chronotons or some crazy particle thing.
Makes everything leave.
Yeah, she shouts no. You know, it's like, well, why didn't they see that coming? I mean,
well, again, I assume,
I mean, that was supposed to be like the final battle.
I assume that they can see things except when the Pa'arets mess with them. I assume that the Pa'arets, also being timeless entities, are able to do stuff that the prophets don't expect and mess up their future vision. That's always been my assumption. Especially since, like, it's weird, because Sisko is, prepare yourselves for Paradox. Sisko is the one that explains to the prophets about time, right?
Right.
But the prophets are the reason Sisko exists. Do you remember that? The prophets possessed Sisko's real mom to get him to have sex with Sisko's dad. And then, like,
Did they possess her, or did they constitute her?
That part's not entirely clear.
The impression I got is that they constituted her because she just disappeared one day.
She didn't disappear. She died in a hover car accident.
Really?
Yep. The implication that I got from it was that they possessed her, got her to have sex with Sisko's dad, had the baby, and then, like, stopped possessing her. And she was suddenly like, wait, what? What's going on? Why am I here?
Why am I in a hover car?
Why is there a baby? And then she left. And then died in a hover car accident mysteriously. And I even got some undertones that maybe the prophets arranged for her death.
Oh my goodness.
Which is a very dark theme for that. And I don't know if that was actually the intention. But regardless, we know the prophets are responsible for Sisko's birth.
Right.
But Sisko is the one that explains to the prophets about time. So, you know, there's a circle here. It's interesting.
My goodness.
But that aside, you know, that's just how the prophets interact with the world. It seems like the prophets were just going about this whole thing really, real half-assed and being like, yeah, we're going to send our dude. He's going to have a phaser rifle. What does your guy got? He's got magic powers. He can shoot lasers out of his eyes, and he can teleport stuff. And he can, you know, burn you with a look.
He can bloodbend.
Yeah, sweet Avatar reference. And then, of course, to round this all out, the final, like, conclusion of this story is that Sisko has to go live in the Celestial Temple. His body has been destroyed, and they basically tell him, you're going to stay here indefinitely. But then he goes back to Cassidy, and he's like, don't worry, Cassidy, I'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
As, like, you don't know you're going to be back. The implication is that you won't be back. No one's, like, giving you a specific timeline, but considering the way the prophets work, you'll probably be gone for a long time. And so he's basically just told Cassidy, don't move on.
Don't move on, Cassidy.
Hey, wife, don't have a life without me. Just wait for me. Trust me. It'll be cool.
It'll be great.
And 70 years later, Cassidy is dying, and she's like, damn, I wish I'd moved on. I could have had boyfriends. You had those regrets in your life. I could have had a life. But no, I spent 70 years waiting for Cisco because he told me he was going to come back, and then he didn't. And no, then, like, 200 years later, Cisco shows up and is like, okay, as I am back. I'm back. Where I told are you I was going to be back eventually.
Where are you?
All right. And that just seemed, that was such a weird, like, that his dialogue with Cassidy conflicted so heavily with his dialogue with the prophets where they explained to him what was up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I didn't really.
Well, he also became timeless, right?
I guess, maybe.
So I think they're doing a little bit of, like, new Star Trek movie time stuff there.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, new reality nonsense. The prophets are
responsible for the Hobus star.
Oh, man. Actually, no, they're not. Well, that's an entire discussion I'll get into at some other point.
Okay.
Because that's a really big topic.
But anyway, so that's my rant on Sisko and Dukat and Space Jesus. All right, so now we're moving on to the last thing on my list that I hate the most, and that is the final portrayal of the Ferengi.
Hmm.
Because, as we all remember, DS9 worked really hard to make the Ferengi into a race you could actually care about. Because, you know, they were originally just a weird caricature of unrestrained capitalism to the point where they were just silly. Like, they weren't scary, they weren't threatening, it was hard to believe they were even a serious race.
What mean Yankee traitor?
Yeah, you know, in the last outpost when they were first introduced in TNG. But DS9 took that and was like, hey guys, what if we made a serious alien species out of this? And they did, and they made some really great characters. We got Quark, Rom, and Nog. I like all three of those. And we got, like, an actual culture. You know, it's a bit of a monoculture, but whatever. That's most Star Trek races are like that. And it's actually interesting. It's got its own depth to it. We find out their morals and why they do the things they do. We got the rules of acquisition, which I will always love. It loves me the rules of acquisition.
Yep.
War is good for business. Peace is good for business. You know how it is. A contract is a contract is a contract. But only amongst Ferengi. Side note. So that's, you know, that's something that I really like about the Ferengi. And then I really like Ishka, Quark and Rom's mother. I think she's a great character. She was apparently actually played by both. Her first appearance, she was played by Andrea Martin. And then afterwards, she was played by Cecily Adams, which I admit I didn't even notice. I did not realize she was played by two different actresses.
Neither did I until you just mentioned it.
Yeah, I was surprised. I only noticed it when I was researching this on Memory Alpha. Because, I mean, she's wearing such heavy makeup that you can't really tell.
Yeah.
There's a whole article on her makeup and how they made her look. But, you know, basically she is, you know, a frustrated financial genius. And she explained, through her we got to see more of what had previously just been the Ferengi. Like, when they first introduced the Ferengi, it was like, well, they hate women because that's a bad thing. And we're going to assign them this trait because we want them to be bad.
Yep.
But then, through Deep Space Nine and Ishka, we learned more about that and more about the Ferengi subjugation of women and how Ishka struggles with it because, again, she's a financial genius. She can make all this profit so easily, but she's not allowed to. And that's her big struggle. And then she has this great relationship with Quark where it's not just... It's actually a little more complicated than Quark not appreciating her. There's more to it than that. Anyway, they spend the entire show building up this interesting relationship, and then they add the Grand Nagus into it, and it gets really interesting, and they add Ishka's, like, crusade for women's rights on Ferenginar. And the whole thing is that Ishka's entire deal is that she's calling in the hypocrisy of Ferengi society, because the Ferengi, their ideal is unrestricted capitalism. They don't believe in taxes or market regulation or anything like that, because the idea is that the best should be able to rise to the top by being the best. You know, they're very objectivist in that way.
Right.
You know, is a man not entitled to the sweat of his lobes? as the Ferengi might say. And then Ishka brings up, hey, wait a minute, guys. We're all about unrestricted capitalism, but we have all these restrictions placed on women for no reason. And she's like, I want to be an unrestricted capitalist. I want to be able to use my financial skills to make a huge fortune, because that's what Ferengi are all about.
Right.
And that's like, you know, her entire motivation. And then, suddenly, at, like, the last minute, the 11th hour of the show in Dogs of War and What You Leave Behind, they shift all that around. And suddenly, Ishka is this driving force for social reform, where she basically introduces a bunch of policies, a bunch of social services through her, you know, her connection to the Grand Nagus, She introduces a bunch of social services and then introduces a bunch of taxes and government and market regulations to pay for them. And then she, like, even has a line where she's talking about how this is going to be the start of a gentler Ferengnar. And it's like, wait, what? Where did this come from? I mean, like, Ishka was a lot of things, but she was never a socialist. And again, I want to make this absolutely clear. This is not my actual opinions on the way economics should work. I'm not talking about this from a political standpoint. This is just from, you know, a story standpoint. And she is, you know, suddenly she's portrayed as not being a fighter for women's rights. She's suddenly portrayed as someone who is just condemning the entire Ferengi way of life and someone who wants them to completely rearrange their civilization. And it just comes out of nowhere. And then, of course, to make matters worse, she basically gets Rom to be the Grand Nagus. And I like Rom. Rom is a good guy, but... And he's not stupid. He's clearly, like, you know, he can figure out machines and stuff, but he's not really a planner. You know, he doesn't plan things. He, you know, he doesn't, like, think ahead. He has none of the qualities you need in a strong leader. And then with this whole gentler Ferengnar thing, we know pretty much from what we learned about Ferengi that the only reason they are able to maintain their sovereignty is by their economic power. Like, they don't really have a military to speak of, and everyone hates them. Like I mean, back me up on this, Bob. Doesn't, like every race we run into hates the Ferengi for one reason or another.
Well, typically because they're just greedy and, you know, they have no... I mean, this is, I think, really exemplified that part of it, specifically in the House of Quark episode.
Yeah.
Where the Klingon is all drunk in his bar, and he stabs himself by falling on Quark and all mm-hmm. this stuff and whatnot. And it's like, it's just so culturally different than a lot of other societies in the respect that they haven't moved past that capitalistic, you know, those capitalistic ideals, that they're considered so different from other species, where people don't like them a whole lot.
Right, and because suddenly
Ishka... I think mm-hmm. what was really happening at the end of the series was that it's like, hey, look, Ferengi, you know, Ferenginar is now going to be more like, you know, the Federation, or becoming more like the Federation is what they're trying to do there. And they used Ishka as, like, the, you know, device
to
get that...
The catalyst for it.
Yeah, because she was the only one who'd actually been making, you know, these kind of moves towards having Ferenginar become more progressive.
Yeah,
right?
But it's just... Like, it just seems
just, it was the only conduit they had for that.
It seems so unnecessary. And, like, again, as, like, what I was saying was that, like, without Ferenginar's, like, extreme economic clout, which they're going to start to give up if they start to act, you know, nicer, because that's, you know, there's a thing about economics. If you're in an economy full of people who don't like you, the way you maintain your clout is by being ruthless. And if the Ferengi are suddenly not willing to do that, what do they have left? I mean, how do they maintain their independence against, in the face of, like, the Federation and the Klingons and the Romulans? I mean, like, I honestly would not be surprised if further down the road we found out that because of all these reforms, the Ferengi Alliance was quickly dissolved and absorbed into the other powers.
Well, Star Trek Online is an indication of what's happening in the future, which I'm still not really clear on if they are or not, because I think it's being treated as soft canon. The Ferengi are very much still their old capitalistic selves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least this, yeah, you know, what was the end of the series? 2374?
Something like that.
So 35 years later, they're still these capitalistic guys, you know,
yeah,
that are all out for about making profit and such. Which, I mean, I don't know how long Ferengi live, but I mean, 35 years is, you know, at least a generation.
Yeah, although we do get an indication that Ishka is over a century old.
There you go.
At one point. But she could just have been lying. I don't know. But so I guess in Star Trek Online, their view is that they're just gonna ignore that whole thing and pretend that it never happened.
Well, that or those, you know, social reforms failed.
Yeah, that,
you know, one of these things. There's not a whole lot given on the Ferengi, you know, on the later kind of part, you know, after DS9 and such.
Right, and then, like, to cap it all off, to just put, like, a, you know, an ice a cherry on this horrible sundae is Quark giving his speech about how his bar will be the last outpost of, you know, of Ferengi values. And
yeah,
it's just, like, I mean, Armin Shimmerman tries, he really tries to make that speech work, but it's just so silly. And it makes me feel like the DS9 writers never took the Ferengi seriously. And, it, you know, after episodes like, you know, The Rules of Acquisition and The Magnificent Ferengi and how awesome Quark was in the Siege of AR-558... It's just so sad that now suddenly he's reduced to, like, prancing around his bar yelling about, you know, outdated economic policies.
Mm-hmm.
And, mean, don't get me wrong, the Ferengi weren't always cool. There was Prophet and Lace, which is the sex change episode.
Yeah.
Because, like, hey guys, so transgenderism is a serious issue that, like, lots of people struggle with, and it's, like, this big thing that we as a culture are still trying to come to terms with. What if we had Quark change sex and perform antics? Wouldn't that be cool? That would be cool, right? But other than episodes like that, the Ferengi were really cool in Deep Space Nine, and then, like, I feel like this was huge character assassination on Ishka, and I don't understand, like, why they decided to do it. It seemed really unnecessary. I felt like the Ferengi were already pretty well developed. I don't think they needed this big shift at the end. I don't understand that choice. There's a lot of weird story decisions. Like, even though I don't like the Space Jesus story, I can sort of understand where it came from and how they were building up to it. But this was, like, such a bizarre turn into left field that I really liked the ending of Deep Space Nine, but that was definitely a fly in the ointment, as it were. That was a black mark.
Uh-huh.
And I don't, especially the Rom as Grand Nagus thing. And it's not like Rom's going to be Grand Nagus and, like, you know, Zek and Ishka are going to be around to advise him. They're retiring to Ryza.
They are retiring to Ryza.
So, like, he's...
I wonder what the retirement rate is towards Ryza.
To Ryza? I mean,
or Casperia Prime.
I would imagine that the retirement homes are on the other side of the planet from the tourist resorts, because we never saw...
Florida.
Aside from Picard, we never saw anyone there over the age of 30. So, either they have, like, magical youth serums, which I wouldn't put it past them, or...
Which we know exist.
Yeah, we do know they exist. Or the people who retire... I remember that. Or the people who retire there don't live in the same place as the tourists. Which, you know, I can totally see that too. But, I mean, that's... So anyway, those are my three really big issues with Deep Space Nine. And I'm sad, I'm glad, I'm happy to say that those are pretty much my only serious issues with Deep Space Nine. There are a couple of individual episodes that I don't terribly care for, but, like, picking apart the series, those are my big problems with it. And they're, against the rest of the series, they're not actually that big a deal. These are, you know, I had to dig pretty deep to come up with these problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, overall, Deep Space Nine is a great show. And I really, really... Yay,
DS9!
Yeah, let's get our DS9 fanboy act on.
Yeah!
And, you know, at first I was sad that there weren't any Deep Space Nine movies, but then I was happy, because I saw what they did with the TNG movies, and I was like, oh, I don't want that to happen to Deep Space Nine. Well,
what would constitute a good DS9 movie? Because the war is over at that point, everything's been kind of really tied up at the end.
We could have a two-parter. The first part of the movie could be called Getting the Gang Back Together, because remember, at the end of Deep Space Nine, they all scatter to the four winds. So, like, the first movie could be just getting everyone back together, and then the second movie could be, I don't know, some kind of random problem happens. Go fix it.
All right.
I actually thought a continuation of the... If I was going to make a Deep Space Nine movie, if someone came to me and was like, you're making a Deep Space Nine movie, or we're going to murder your kids. I don't have any kids, but, you know, if that was the sort of implication... then I would make a movie about Section 31. That would be my Deep Space Nine movie. Because Section 31 was a really cool plot device that, you know, they used, but they never played it all the way out. Like, there was still a lot of stuff going on with Section 31 that we didn't get to see a whole lot of. And I think that would have made a good Deep Space Nine movie. But I think I'm pretty much done for this week. I had a great time. I feel, you know, cathartically purged from this rant. And so what are we talking about next week, Bob?
What are we talking about next week?
I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about the best...
I never know what we're going to talk about next week until the end of the episode.
I think we're going to be talking about the best and worst cultures of Star Trek Online. Specifically Star Trek Online.
Oh,
I was
originally
just going to make it all of Star Trek, but then I realized we'd be here for like 5 hours.
We can do another series.
So we're going to specifically talk about the cultures of Star Trek Online. Because I know that's something you've been wanting to talk about for a while now.
Yeah.
All right.
There's definitely some of them... I mean, some that we already know and love that are in Star Trek Online that,
Well, we can talk about...
I feel need to be kind of talked about.
Yeah.
And how bad they are.
All right. Well, we will get to that, and we will see you guys all next
week. Bye, guys.